Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Dial. How are you?
I'm great. It's a beautiful day in August. It's good to speak with you again. We've done this once before, and we have yet to actually meet. So this is a good little reunion. introductions?
Yeah, well, I'm Michelle Goldberg. I'm a columnist for the Daily Beast. I'm the author of a couple of books, most recently The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World, which I would be remiss in saying, not saying, that it just came out in paperback.
Do it. It's great. I reviewed the book, and I think it's excellent. And we've mentioned that here before. I'm Dia Olapade. I am a political reporter for the Daily Beast and a fellow at New America and in Chicago. So I guess the place to start, there's always so many controversies du jour, but the controversy maybe of the last week or so has been surrounding the construction of a mosque and community center near the site.
Yeah, well, and I think it's important to say that it is a community center, because it's like part of the problem is that it's already got this appellation of the Ground Zero Mosque, which is in itself a kind of, you know, death panel like distortion. I've often been upset about the so-called Israel lobby and how it kind of purports to represent me as an American Jew, but rarely as upset and kind of appalled and disappointed as I am right now. Like, I mean, the position of the Anti-Defamation League in particular on the, on the Cordoba Initiative or the Cordoba Center, it is so disgraceful and so deeply hypocritical. The only kind of saving grace in all of this is that apparently the reaction to Abe Foxman's opposition to the building of the center has been really, really fierce. There, you know, I think much more so than he expected. There was an article in the Forward today in which the Forward, which is, you know, a Jewish newspaper in New York, both called them out for their, you know, for taking this position that's so disgraceful and so hypocritical, but also, you know, kind of noted that there's been a huge amount of blowback, as there should be, because, you know, it's just
incredibly tone deaf, right? I mean,
well, it's not just that it's tone deaf. It's also that the ADL, I mean, if it's not just going to be a kind of like pressure group for American Jews, if it's going to have any sort of broader, you know, kind of commitment, or, you know, if it's any kind of broader moral vision, which, you know, is increasingly ridiculous to talk about a broader moral vision in the same sentence as Abraham Foxman. But if that's what it aspires to have, and that is what it's had at times, then kind of ganging up with the majority, you know, with kind of the Christian right against the rights of religious minorities, especially religious, and kind of smearing them. He's been so smarmy in both kind of intimating that there might be terrorist ties, which there are not, and then at the same time saying, no, I'm not, kind of, you know, at the same, he's kind of talking out of both sides of his mouth, you know, which is allowing people to assume that there might be some suspicion of something wrong, even though he can't quite articulate it, won't articulate it. It's like
using scare quotes, right? The, like, alleged mosque on Ground Zero. And I do think this has suffered, the discourse around this has suffered from a lack of clarity. I think you're right that there's been some fudging, and even sort of, you're quite right to compare it to the death panel, because it's an easy shorthand. And you say the Ground Zero Mosque, and it somehow seems more nefarious than it actually is. And it is a community center. But it's also, I mean, what struck me about the whole conversation is that the Ground Zero location, you know, what if it were 30 blocks away? Mm-hmm. What is it that is so significant about having a center of worship for, I mean, and obviously, you know, you have seen Mayor Michael Bloomberg's very eloquent speech about religious freedoms in New York City and America in general. And he points out that there are Muslims that, of course, died in the World Trade Center attacks, who were first responders in the World Trade Center attacks, and how symbols get away from us so easily. And that's fair. But the more enduring ones are the symbols of religious freedom that are in the very DNA of the American project. And it's just forgetfulness and sloth and laziness, I would say, in articulating what's at stake here that has really made it the most disappointing, I suppose, for me.
the other thing that's so disappointing is that so many of the people who are kind of coming out against the mosque, including, or God, I keep saying that because I guess, but so many people are coming out against the Cordoba Center, that so many people are coming out against it are typically, you know, kind of defender, you know, they, and there was a story about this on the Upshot, the new Yahoo News blog, that so many of these people kind of, whenever somebody wants to, say, block the building of a temple or a church or kind of assert historical preservation over kind of, you know, religious, whenever there's one of these zoning issues about religious buildings, these groups are the first ones to kind of talk about religious freedom and how, you know, religious freedom and private property must, you know, be kind of, you know, the right. paramount values. It's the hypocrisy is so incredibly naked. It's really, right. and it also, it makes me so angry. I mean, Abraham Foxman is in New York, but most of these people are not New Yorkers. You know, most of these people right. are people who treat New York with such contempt.
Right.
You know, like Sarah Palin, although she, I guess she actually likes it here more than she lets on. Because she's
well, Newt Gingrich quite fond is of like sort of the primary offender here. And he referred to elite Americans as sort of defending, I don't know who, I mean, it was just, again, another symbol, but sort of a catchword that is empty in a sort of general sense. He talked about elite Americans wanting to preserve their, I mean, none of it is coherent. None of it is logical. But when you use enough, when you apply enough pressure to enough buzzwords, you tend to get results. Thankfully, there's been, you know, it's been encouraging to see the amount of backlash surrounding the construction of the community center, and to see obviously Bloomberg stand up for it, and for others to do so. And I think the useful point is made that, you know, this is a test of not just our religious freedoms, but the separation of church and state. I mean, there's no reason for the state of New York or the city of New York to infringe upon right of free assembly, and free association, and religion. And that would be extended to any number of places. I mean, there are churches right on Ground Zero. I believe there's, I'm forgetting the name of the church that stood after the attacks.
Well, and also, and people seem to think that the area around Ground Zero was some kind of, like, hallowed ground.
Right.
Like, you know, people have compared it to right. Auschwitz. You know, but it's not, I'm sure, I haven't counted, but I'm positive there's a McDonald's within 2 blocks of Ground Zero. I mean, it's, like, basically, you know, a kind of pretty tawdry commercial area.
That's absolutely right.
There's, you know, there's Century 21, a kind of discount department
right.
store half
right,
a block
right.
away.
And a lot of this is being lobbed at, I mean, the debate is happening outside of New York City, obviously. Fair enough. I've always been a little confused about the sort of zealousness with which people treat issues of national security and security in general, who are not living in, I mean, I live in Washington, D.C. Surely, if anyone is going to go down in some sort of apocalyptic nuclear event, it's going to be you or me.
Right.
and not, I don't know, wherever Newt Gingrich lives, and certainly not going to be Sarah Palin, but there you have it.
You know,
No, go ahead.
I just want to say one other thing that has been driving me crazy about this whole thing is the comparison to Auschwitz, and specifically mm-hmm. the comparison, you know, a few years ago, or more than a few years ago, I think it was during the 80s, there was some nuns who tried to start a Carmelite convent, basically on the grounds of Auschwitz, and they were going to be kind of praying for perpetually praying for two Catholics who died at Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. One was a Jewish convert. One was a priest who had actually been a publisher of an anti-Semitic journal before the war. And people objected to this. You know, and people objected to this. It was basically saying this is trying to kind of Christianize the grounds of a very specifically Jewish tragedy, even though, you know, Jews aren't the only victims of Auschwitz. They were obviously the predominant ones.
What was,
it is so
what
incredibly,
was the circumstances for the conversion?
What's that?
The
oh,
Catholic
the,
converted to Judaism or vice versa.
Oh, she converted to Catholicism. I mean,
okay.
you know, people,
yeah,
people
yeah, yeah,
do.
Okay.
It wasn't,
sorry, go ahead.
You know, and so... But basically, it's just not the same. I mean, it's not the same both because that really was on the grounds. It's not the same because Auschwitz was specific to Judaism in a way that Ground Zero is not specific. I mean, what was hit
right.
in Ground Zero was not a specific religion, but actually the kind of a symbol of the ultimate symbol of cosmopolitanism.
Right. And, well, capitalism, more than that.
I just mean
know.
An attack. I don't, right.
No,
I don't
I
mean
totally
the buildings themselves, but I mean
there's
an attack
been some,
on downtown
like,
New York.
There have been some ugly comparisons and, you know, fringy elements of the blogosphere with respect to abortion and slavery, which I really don't even want to start talking about, but it's just sort of like ugly, and people need to be more precise and more delicate in their analogies. Shorthand is sort of like, is always sort of very suspect, especially when you're dealing with sort of these sort of
It's funny to be kind of, for me to be in this position, because I wrote something quite recently. I actually think that in general, like, liberals and leftists should be less sensitive towards Islam. I really do. I think that there's a lot of kind of tiptoeing around fundamentalism. I thought it was, like, really appalling when Yale University Press refused to print the Danish Mohammed cartoons in a book about the Danish Mohammed cartoons. You know, in general, like, I tend to side more with the kind of people who are, you know, kind of aggressively in favor of blasphemy.
But there's also, like, there are extreme abuses of the symbolic role that Islam has come to play in the American psyche since 9/11. I would point to this sort of, I don't actually even know who believes this, but people who are interested in promoting the idea that Sharia law will sort of somehow take root in the United States. It seems so wholly inconsistent to sort of believe that, you know, be so exceptionalist about American might and then also ever fearful of encroachments from other foreign types of influence, not to speak of overhauling the entire American judicial system to conform to a version of law that is written in the Quran. I mean, people are abusive of what is a, for the most part, peaceful religion. Obviously, there are elements of it that are being abused in the same sort of way, but it is just disappointing. I mean, I guess, I don't know. Maybe we should move on. I mean, it seems pretty clear that we agree that this is a sort of ugly episode, but that actually was something that produced a victory for the sane people in that, you know, it seems that this Historic Preservation Commission is stepping out of it and that the community center will proceed unfettered. And that gives you some hope, I suppose, that in when push comes to shove, you know, this country isn't so crazy.
Likewise,
I do think... Sorry, go ahead.
I think it redeems Michael Bloomberg, who was, you know, such a kind of quisling figure during the Republican National Convention in 2004, where people who, you know, have always kind of shit over everything this city stands for came and kind of celebrated their dominance, and he was right there with them while the city of New York was basically put under lockdown. I mean, it was this disgraceful, disgraceful thing. And so now I feel like finally, I mean, that speech...
It was
really,
great.
Really,
it said everything I wanted to hear.
A lot of the, and you know, a lot of the things I've hated about parts of his tenure. And I mean, it really was. You know, I'm you know, very much a kind of New York City patriot.
Right.
And you know, I thought it was like a huge victory, both the speech and the fact that people have been pretty much undaunted. I mean, it's not just that it passed, but it passed unanimously in terms of the historical preservation.
Right. Well, there was excellent news from the other coast of the U.S. this week, at least from my perspective, in that Proposition 8, which was passed in 2008, the day that Barack Obama was elected president, and overturned.
On his birthday.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that interesting? Well, you know what? We can get to this, but I don't know if that was a happy present for Obama. At any rate, you know, we had a bipartisan team of lawyers basically shred the hell out of this, in my opinion, unfair ruling, or sorry, legislative act or referendum that was passed in 08. And it seems that for now, gay marriages are not happening in the state. For a few hours they were, and then the judge sort of put a stay on this, on the ruling, such that there can be an appeal, and we're likely to see the case go to the Supreme Court. But gay marriage proponents were obviously rejoicing about this. I think the most,
you know, they were rejoicing, but there's also a real current of anxiety, which is that, you know, initially there was always in, like, you know, people who've been involved in this fight for a long time, a lot of them were pretty angry about this lawsuit, which they saw as kind of both showboating in a way that's moving something into the federal realm before it's ready. You know,
what do we mean by ready, though? Because that's a really interesting. I mean, is it before the population is ready to embrace perhaps national legislation regarding gay marriage?
No, I don't even think
marriage,
it's so. Well, I think
California.
It's a combination of the population and
the argumentation itself wasn't ready.
No, I think it was basically that a kind of recognition that there's a kind of synergy between popular sentiment and Supreme Court rulings, and that.
Maybe recently, but I mean, that's not, I mean, today, I believe, is the 45th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, which was well ahead of where the American people were back in 1965, and we should be glad of it. I mean, I do think that there's a real tension, and this is where the sort of whole debate around judicial activism or what have you, and it's particularly germane to this instance because it was a popular referendum. You had gay marriage legislated in other states, in Iowa, in Maine, I believe in Massachusetts as well, whereas this was a vote taken from the people, sort of more direct, if you want to call it that, type of democracy that was then overturned by a court, and we will see that conversation continue on, I imagine, in the U.S. Supreme Court. And so the question is, how does readiness factor in the American people versus American legislatures versus politics? I personally have been very surprised, or rather unsurprised, that neither political party is particularly pleased that this sort of time bomb has been dropped in their laps just a few months before the midterm elections. It doesn't seem, I mean, obviously, perhaps not obviously, it's an issue that will be diminishing in its significance over time, I suspect, but at the moment is still, no one has a good sense of what the public feels and how much of a whether people actually vote on this issue, I guess, is the real concern.
Well, the people who vote on this, I mean, the people who vote on this issue are not voting for Democrats anyway. And the people who vote on this issue are already super mobilized.
I think people vote on this issue for Democrats. I mean, I do think that it's not just a
negative.
Oh, no, but
I see what you're saying. Yeah, no, you're right.
Although, and so how much is this, I mean, in the face of, you know, the jobs numbers came out today and they're not good. I mean, we have unemployment is steady at 9.5%. And, all the jobs, I mean, we expected contraction because of the census ending and all those jobs sort of evaporating. But the economy is still pretty hard up. In that case, like, is this really the time to pick a culture war fight when
I think it's obviously the time for the Republican Party to do that. I mean, the Republican Party because the Republican Party basically wants to whip up populist sentiment in the sense of being kind of aggrieved, which is, you know, a kind of totally valid sentiment, but they actually don't want to offer economic remedies, you know, there. And so the best way to do that is to channel people's sense of aggrievement onto some kind of cultural elite. So actually these issues are tailor-made for this sort of time.
I can't believe that it's still, okay, so I'm a Republican strategist, and I've got a candidate who's running in a district that maybe went for Obama by 55%. And it's not doing well. Perhaps it's an industrial state where job loss has been huge. Perhaps you've had a bunch of state layoffs that now you've had congressional legislation try and deal with. You've had unemployment benefits. People have pushed their 99 weeks. They're out of work. They're not getting their checks. Am I really going to sit there and say, in California, we have this grievous threat to our democracy? I just don't think that they're operating on the same register of complaints. So if you're going to whip up popular sentiment, perhaps there are other ways to do it. You could talk about GM. You could talk about TARP. You could talk about whatever you wanted in a way that is probably disingenuous, in that TARP was passed, you know, under Bush by most people in Congress, including lots of Republicans. But that just, I just wouldn't focus on gay marriage were I that strategist. I mean, I think there's a lot of red meat out there, and this seems oddly mismatched
at
the moment.
If you look at some of the, you know, some of the campaign ads in Tennessee and South Carolina, and, you know, admittedly some of these candidates are not winning their primaries, you know, or if you look at the Sharon Angle campaign in Nevada, there's so much of, you know, the reason that we're suffering now is because we've gotten away from being a Christian nation and we've moved into this, you know, kind of sense of, you know, we've moved into this, you know, kind of decadent, morally depraved phase. And, you know, once we kind of regain our values and stop worshiping, you know, start petitioning God instead of government, then, you know, kind of God will provide. I mean, that's the subtext of so many of these right-wing campaigns. And so this really adds to that, I think.
Well, I guess I disagree. I mean, I think that, again, like, the economy is the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth most salient political issue mm-hmm. during this election season. I also think that, you know, there is going to be a schism of sorts within the Republican Party between older and younger folks who might have shared beliefs with respect to morals, family values, this sort of all of the boogeymen that came out of the 2004 election where people were voting on cultural values. But there's, you know, this concept that over time, you know, it's just not going to be, I can't see this being an issue for the midterm elections 2030. I can't.
2030?
And so people, who are laying down the tent poles now are going to be looked at like Strom Thurmond, like, eventually.
Right, but they're also
and so there is, I think that people are being a little bit more withholding about being as venomous and sort of, I mean, particularly across age, across the generational gap. And I don't, I just, I see it, I mean, I think even Obama is probably the last Democratic nominee, presuming that he runs again in 2012. By 2016, I don't think you're going to see a Democratic nominee being nominally against gay marriage. I mean, I think we're there. We're getting, quote unquote, there. And we'll have to see what he does. And I mean, even the fact that, okay, Boas and Olson are, it was like a bipartisan team of lawyers that took this case and argued it so well. The relative uncontroversy surrounding the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I think, is actually an interesting weather vane with respect to where people are in the issue, not personally, but in terms of how politically relevant it is to their voting habits.
I think it's losing its salience. And I think it has a sense of diminishing returns and that it's not going to be as big of an issue as it was in 2004. And, you know, one of the kind of lessons I thought of this, both the trial and then the decision, was just that the other side, you know, nobody can even really pretend at this point that there's a rational argument against gay marriage.
Right.
You know, the only kind of argument against gay marriage is rooted in a kind of rigid religious ideology. You know, and so this judge, which is now being, you know, denounced as this kind of radical leftist and is being, you know, attacked. I think he's a little bit don't ask, don't tell about his own sexuality. But, you know, right. They're saying, oh, he's gay, he should have recused himself. I mean, the interesting mm-hmm. thing is that this was a judge who, when Reagan appointed him, gay people protested him and Democrats kept him off the bench because he was seen as being unfriendly to gays, lesbians, and women. You know, so this is, yeah. And, you know, and then finally George H.W. Bush finally put him up on the bench after he was blocked under Reagan. I mean, this was someone who, you know, represented the U.S. Olympic Committee when they sued the Gay Olympics for mm-hmm. trademark infringement. This is someone who was, you know, criticized for belonging to some kind of all-male social club. You know, this is a pretty actually establishment Republican of the old school. And,
go ahead.
Well, and I just thought the fact that his argument was so broad and so decisive and kind of evinced so little patience for the, right. you know, for like the tautologies and the kind of bad faith arguments of the other side. I mean, I thought it was a brilliant argument in part because it was so incredibly hard to argue with and it kind of brought right. out so many of the premises.
Oh, it's going to be argued with. I mean, I guess I'm sympathetic to the idea that I mean, we obviously have a constitution that has a process for dealing with issues of this nature, which is why this case will go to the Supreme Court and will be decided there. I am sympathetic to the idea that it is not a popular decision in the sort of basic literal sense of the word, in that it was a judge who ruled on the case and outcomes are affecting individuals and many feel for the better, but some feel for the worse. You know, obviously the argument against that is that particularly in California, I mean, you know, the state is so schizophrenic in its political outcome, particularly because it has the ability to have all these ballot initiatives, these referendums. The three strikes law is a fantastic example of people sort of wanting to sort of having a vague sense that crime is a problem and that they want to make offenders pay. It's a horrible policy. No one thinks that it's a good idea. And to boot, it's extraordinarily expensive. Mm-hmm. The state has had to build some 12 to 15 prisons in the last year since the referendum passed. And so there's a schizophrenia in that people vote for things based on what they think, you know, they believe or what they actually believe, let's say. But then government isn't supportive or but then, you know, their taxes go up or there's an enormous budget shortfall. And so there is a set. I mean, that is why we have a representative democracy where, you know, people who you could call them elites or you could call them elected officials. You know, when it comes to judicial decisions of this nature, there is a disconnect, perhaps. But as I mentioned earlier, with respect to the enormous amount of legislation that came through in the 60s that produced a system that is more equal and more fair for all Americans, sometimes that is better. So we'll just have to see.
Oh, yeah, no, I basically agree that the courts are not there to defer to majority opinion. But right. I also think that I think that the backlash is going to be, you know, when somebody pointed out to me, I said the word backlash, and they said, what do you mean backlash? They were, like, lashing long before we did any of this. But I think that the reaction on the right is going to be very, very strong, even if it's a kind of last gasp of this sort of homophobia, okay. And even if it's, you know, kind of generationally suicidal for the Republican Party. You know, so is their position on immigration, just, you know, kind of demographically. But that doesn't right. stop them. And so sure. among the, you know, so I just think, you know, given the kind of salience of arguments about judicial activism, you know, given the recent confirmation of Elena Kagan and, you know, the fact that.
No, I think I remain sympathetic to the idea that who represents you and who makes seismic decisions that affect the nature of American sort of the body politic, it matters. These people matter. I mean, this is why elections matter. When it comes to the case of our judicial system, I mean, I think that's also a debate that I don't think we had adequately before Kagan's confirmation. You know, how is it that people come to be powerful? You know, I've spent a decent amount of time here in D.C. I don't think that there's one path to power, but there mm-hmm. is, and this has been brought up, surrounding Kagan's nomination and confirmation hearings, there is a certain amount of sort of clubbiness. And I was sort of very taken by, you know, this guy has been sort of attacking Kagan systematically for, you know, since she was essentially nominated. And I'm going to see if I can find it. Hold on. I want to read.
Are you talking about the lawyer sends in money piece?
Yeah. This is, hold on. Okay, right. So, the relative ease with which Elena Kagan is being confirmed to a lifetime appointment on Supreme Court illustrates the extent to which establishment America, uppercase, believes that a member of the club in good standing, someone who has gone to the right schools and gotten the right kind of jobs and befriended the right sorts of people, can be counted on to do the right thing, even though her own legal and political views remain largely unknown. I think that's a really fair argument.
I think it's overstated. I think that there's elements of truth in it, and I certainly...
With respect to Kagan or generally...
I think there's an element of, it's clearly true generally. I don't know that Kagan is like the kind of ultimate representation of, you know, kind of American elitism. I mean, it's clearly, you know, as someone, I went to all public schools. I put myself through school. You know, I went to college on a full scholarship. And, you know, I guess, I mean, Berkeley's a good school where I went to graduate school, but again, you know, public school on a scholarship. And it's really, you know, since I've kind of been living in New York and working in journalism, working in publishing, I think I completely underestimated when I was younger how much of an advantage there would have been in going to an Ivy League school. I mean, it didn't really even cross my mind when I was going to college. I was, you know, I started college pretty young. I was 16. I just wanted to, like, you know, get out of my house and be on my own. And it honestly never yeah. ever occurred to me. And
well,
now,
I mean,
now
that's
how
it goes, right?
What?
That's what I mean, it's just like you're in a club and you can't really be kicked out. I mean, this whole concept of sort of failing up is
well, it's really, I think
endemic
it's, I think that it's really astonishing.
Washington, the Acela corridor, let's say. And mm-hmm. I think that there are problems with it. I mean, I think meritocracy has come to mean so many particular things, you know, the sort of best and the brightest syndrome that our country has suffered from since whatever, Vietnam or even previously to it. And Obama has, I think, it's fair to critique him for sort of having swallowed that wholesale because he's been a beneficiary of it. I mean, so have I, for goodness sake. But the question
well,
is whether
or
not
there's two different points here, because one of them, I mean, I read the Lawyers, Guns, and Money piece is essentially arguing that Kagan is intellectually unworthy. I mean, I don't see any problem in general with saying, yeah, you do want the best and the brightest, and, you know, really smart people often come out of really good schools, and
right.
those are the people that you want in government.
The critique there, though, is that the argument is made within the frame of legal academia. He's mm-hmm. judging Kagan within the same system that he's purporting to critique in some level. He's saying
but
she
so
didn't
his
publish
argument,
enough.
His argument
within the
basically
sort of traditional...
is that she doesn't cut it, and that it's just because she has a certain pedigree that she's, as he argued,
well,
has
I was
been
sympathetic
upwards.
To the fact that the way she got her pedigree was not particularly sort of, I mean, the wheels were greased, but there were moments where in her career where she was sort of in crisis, where she didn't have a job, she had abandoned tenure at UChicago, to try and sort of leap into government. She was stagnating there at a sort of like mid-level position within the Domestic Policy Council. And she kind of fought for her life to get to Harvard. And then within 3 or 4 years was the dean of the law school. And so I don't know whether to read that as a sort of scrappy underdog within a system that sort of, you know, as a woman, as someone who is, you know, from a middle class up to upper middle class family in New York, who is a minority ethnically. I mean, all those things are relevant, I suppose, but all, again, operate within the same system of privilege that is completely foreclosed to the vast majority of folks. And I do think that the debate, I mean, if you look at the law schools that are represented on the court, I think it's a completely fair point to say, you know, why not reach a little further? I believe Diane Wood, I think she went to Northwestern. She was another one of the top sort of front runners. Pam Carlin, I believe, went to UT Austin. All fantastic schools, but who are sort of, you know, maybe there are other considerations, obviously, but it's just so easy for Obama and the people advising him to say, well, let's take, you know, this will look good. You can't really argue with this. And I think you can argue with it, but we don't have a framework for doing so.
You know, I would have rather seen Diane Wood, but I also think, you know, this piece was, I thought, unfair because that whole narrative he tells about how she basically had this career crisis after leaving the
right.
after leaving the Clinton administration and not being able to go back to the University of Chicago.
Yeah.
Again, to me, that kind of, that's not, that also kind of, the fact that she then came back kind of complicates the narrative of her as being just this,
right.
you know, of being kind of like basically a grown-up Tracy Flick. I mean, it actually shows a certain amount of kind of, you can interpret it
gumption,
to say that it shows
right.
a certain amount of resilience, you know, and kind of, some degree of risk-taking early in her
right.
career.
I mean, where I think this is interesting sort of read against this way that our Congress works, I think this is a very interesting conversation, again, referring to the idea of who merits authority in this country. You know, I've spent a decent amount of time covering Congress. I worked on the Hill for my very first time in Washington during the summer that the prescription drug reimportation debate was going on. And it seems to me, and George Packer has written a great piece about the Senate and its dysfunction in a recent issue of The New Yorker, that expertise is actually not privileged on the Hill. It really is heavily focused, as opposed to the way the Supreme Court works, on political ability and fundraising ability, which of course sort of like erodes and retards the ability to sort of think clearly about public policy across a spectrum of issues. But there are very few experts who represent Americans in Congress. There are a few, and they're the older ones, who have had experience on committees, who have worked, say, on national security issues or budgetary issues for a very long time, or who have private sector experience that perhaps sort of endows them with an ability to look at tax policy or regulatory policy with sort of enlightened eyes. But for the most part, you have politicians making policy, and that struck me as a very dangerous
Well, of course you're going to have politicians making... I mean, the thing is, of course you're going to have politicians making policy.
I mean, that's how it's been, but it seems worse than ever in terms of
oh, it's clearly
the actual outcomes.
I mean...
When I was working on the Hill, and we'd spent a bunch of the summer working to sort of say we can reimport, you know, Viagra from Canada without, you know, whatever, without people dying, you know, from whatever, tampering and such. And there's 3 months of, like, long debate, much like what's happened with the energy bill this summer in the Senate. And then it dies. it's just the ultimate sort of, it's not even a sunk cost. I mean, it's just like nothing has happened. Like, you've done all this conversation and all these things have happened. You've talked about it, and then the bill dies, and then nothing happens. And that seems to be the case over and over again. If you look at what Nancy Pelosi's caucus has done in the House, they've passed everything Obama's asked them to pass. It's all gotten caught up in the Senate. And Packer, I mean, unpacks not so much the reasons why the policies aren't, it's not that we don't know what good policy is, it's that the system is sort of engineered to not produce outcomes. And that seems, perhaps based on his description of what's going on and based on my observation, to be completely based upon personality, which is, I guess, how I'm dividing that from sort of expertise. Which is a sort of.
It didn't even seem that it was based on, I mean, even personality. Like in the old days, you know, the old days, I guess it's probably, you shouldn't.
No, let's say the 80s.
Romanticize. You know, you had. But I guess in the old days, you know, you had kind of huge personalities who, you know, even if they were working like in the proverbial back rooms, that was a different kind of political skill that was privileged. You know, the ability to cut deals and trade favors and, you know, be good at this kind of sausage making process that was at least interpersonal.
Right.
Whereas, I mean, part of the problem is partisanship, although I really hate complaining about partisan. I mean, I don't think the problem is partisanship. I think the problem is the kind of complete hardening of the, basically the Republican Party has turned into, you know, kind of a faction that, you know, Barry Goldwater would have considered far too extremist. I mean,
well, yeah, I mean, there's that anecdote where it's like, you know, Susan Collins or someone, I'm forgetting now, wanted to vote for a piece of legislation. They were like, you will not. And
well,
I can understand the incentives
Collins,
there. What are the incentives for this person to not do what they think is the right thing? And the fact that they're so powerful was the most troubling element, I suppose.
There's an anecdote of Susan Collins wanting to have lunch with the Democrats and telling them not to tell anybody about it.
Right, exactly. I mean, I guess, you know, there's this whole conversation about, like, the 60-vote problem, and there's an increasing sort of agitation for filibuster reform or sometime. I mean, the last time that it was reformed was in 75. You know, maybe we're ripe for change. But maybe this legislative year maybe the session of Congress looks different if it's 55-45. I don't know if that's the case, but maybe it does. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, we're about to go into a long season of nothing. Certainly after the midterms, I suspect it will be a lame duck session where you'll do, you know, the naming of post offices. But there's not going to be the major legislative moves we've seen with financial reform, with the stimulus, with healthcare reform, because people are so dug in. I don't know whether any of that would have happened, however. I mean, maybe the entire session would have been lame duck if it had been a smaller margin of Democratic majority. And we will see, certainly after November, what it looks like when you have, I imagine, more Republican seats in the Senate and perhaps a smaller margin in the House. I'm not optimistic, but you have to think that the being irrelevant part of being in a super minority skews behavior. It's not good, but I understand that, and perhaps we'll see with more egalitarian distribution after the midterms better outcomes.
I would put money on it that that's not going to happen. I don't think that there's a slight chance that the Republicans, if they have more strength, will somehow become more congenial.
Well, what do you make of, like, I mean, Congress has always had really, really low approval ratings, Democratic, Republican presidents, no matter what. But all these sort of, like, ethics violations, I mean, they've been somewhat concentrated in the CDC, but, you know, you could extend them to some of the sort of, like, the sexual dalliances of various senators on the Republican side. That takes a toll, but it's also the kind of thing where, particularly with, you know, Maxine Waters and Charlie Rangel, they're some of the longest-serving members of their caucus. And that just, I mean, perhaps forecloses, like, good judgment from them? Like, I don't know. I mean, I tend to find whenever I go to the Hill that everyone is incredibly old. And while in the case of someone perhaps like Henry Waxman, that's useful. But in some cases, John Dingell, I would even point out, Rangel, there's just, I mean, Harry Reid, even I would say Nancy Pelosi, who knows her way around, but is also, I think she's 76 or something, just not a good image to put forward as, like, the leadership of America, right? I mean, it's not a good... It's just like a bunch of old, sometimes a little less white and a little less male, but for the most part, unrepresentative of the country. It's just not a good image.
Well, I mean, and part of that is that, I mean, I think that it used to be this is also a kind of crisis of American elites, you know, kind of people coming out of the smartest people, you know, when you meet really smart people, the last thing they want to do is run for office. You know, they might want to spend right. a little bit of time in government, but it's kind of, you know, in general, only kind of hacks and egomaniacs, I think, to a right. much greater extent than in the past.
Right.
Or, you know, the occasional, like, crazy dreamer. You know, there's obviously people in Congress I respect, but it's just, I don't think, I mean, I think that kind of young people of distinction used to be much more likely to consider a political career than they are today. And no wonder. I mean, you read the story, you read the George Packer story, and it sounds like, you know, I don't know whether it sounds like it's like a Kafka novel or like,
right.
you know, Monty Python, but it's just.
Right. And even some of the younger like, freshmen, I mean, like Amy Klobuchar is mentioned, you could put Scott Brown in that category. You could certainly put like, you know, Mark Warner in that category. They're like, what is going on? This is not what I signed up for. And this is all interesting in the context of this African Leaders Summit that's went on all of last week here in D.C., where it actually did seem like, you know, the State Department sort of hosted 120 young Africans under the age of 35 to sort of flag the fact that the continent has 60% of the population under 35. Brought them to D.C., rolled out the red carpet, you know, brought them to the White House, like, took them to the roof of the W, made them feel like royalty, and made them feel as though the continent's future and the future of their individual countries is very much in their hands. And there was an expectation that they would be involved in government. And it sort of cuts against my sort of vague bias toward sort of private sector development, certainly in emerging markets. But it just struck me as so different. I mean, I don't know what 120 people in America we could bring to the White House and say, you're going to run the country in the future. I don't know how that looks different. But it was just very interesting to see these people buying into the idea that politics is something that they can do and should do, and it will produce outcomes. Even in countries where, you know, the political situation and state of democracy is much worse.
Well, actually, I mean, it seems like if the political system, the state of democracy is much weaker, I mean, it's obviously much, much more difficult and more dangerous to get in politics. But you also, you know, are kind of more likely, or maybe not more likely. I mean, I still think Obama's an extraordinary figure. But, you know, you see leaders of movements and kind of extraordinary people rise to the top in those kind of situations. I mean, not all the time, but, you know, you might see, you know, some of the, say, like in Ellen Sirleaf, Ellen Sirleaf Young.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you see, again, not always, you know, but someone like it, you can see, you know, heroic figures occasionally can come to the fore in those kind of situations. I actually do see Obama as being that kind of figure still, despite the, you know, rampant disappointment with him among other progressives. But
right.
I think our system is much more, there's, you know, there's just many more layers to.
Well, I guess it just surprised me at how much more positive people felt about government service than I perceive, even among the sort of young politicos in my cohort, that you could be more optimistic about the prospects for functional democracy in Kenya than you could in, like, Kansas, right? I mean, that's just remarkable to me.
But also because, I mean, if you're a young person and you want to kind of build something, you know, the very fact that Kenya is, I mean, you know, it's not like Kenya is a basket case, even though it's been, you know,
yeah, no, they just passed a new constitution this week.
Right.
Like, why can't we do that? Right.
But so Kenya's, so what I'm saying is that it actually, I mean, I would see that the fact that there's so much to build as opposed to just kind of being a cog in a very gummed up machine.
Right.
Would
the clean
attract
slate,
kind of
right.
young idealists where, you know, nobody really thinks that you can, that, you know, or very few people think that even the kind of right person, you know, even the most committed people in the world can do very much to change a kind of corroded,
right,
bloated system that we see that we're stuck with.
Well, I mean, I guess this is not, I mean, we didn't plan to discuss this, but I, in the context, like the idea of sort of youthful indiscretion and barriers to, again, this sort of authority, barriers to authority and what remains a barrier to authority. We've seen sex scandals among politicians. It's kind of a toss-up. You never know who's going to get taken down and who's going to get to stay in office. But with respect to this whole sort of a journalist phenomenon, I don't know if you've gotten the chance to read Micah Sifry's sort of like, you know, parsing of this idea that you have things that you have to apologize for, and then when do we forgive people for them, and what is, you know, transparency as the new objectivity, certainly for journalists, really spoke to me in that sense, because there's no, like, why would you want to get into this hustle? You know, it's, why would you want to live a public life, I guess, is really the question.
But at this point, why do you want to live a public life? I mean, you kind of get dragged into living a public life, whether you like it or not. I mean, people are being treated as public figures who in the past would have, you know, never merited any scrutiny whatsoever. Right. I mean, it's kind of, you know, like this, I mean, the journalist thing is an example of this. There's a few successful, you know, really kind of well-known people in journalists, but there's also a lot of people who are,
and that's the sort of joy of it,
who are being, like, you know, I thought it was disgraceful what Jonathan Strong did to Sarah Seltzer of, worked at a public radio station in San Francisco. And at one point had said something like, oh, I'm, you know, if I saw Rush Limbaugh having a heart attack, I would, you know, I wouldn't help him. I'd laugh. I mean, that's kind of things that people say in casual conversation all the time.
Right.
Not necessarily about Rush Limbaugh, but like, you know, I wouldn't give him a drink of water if he was, you know, you know, dying of thirst in the desert.
It's the fact that it was inscribed. I mean, you know, if it were, that's basically what she meant. But because she wished death upon him, it became a thing, right?
Wait, what's that?
The fact that it was written, the fact that it was inscribed, made it impossible to sort of convey the sentiment, which is that she wouldn't give him a drink of water, when it became and actually wished death upon him, because it was sort of, because it was written. Right? I mean, that was the distinction.
Well, and also I think that Jonathan Strong wrote it with such a kind of, like, prissy literalism. Like, you know, most people, if they saw a man having a heart attack, would stop and help. But not if you're liberal Sarah Seltzer.
The whole thing
was like, you know, such a kind of deliberate refusal to understand, you know, kind of obvious shadings of meaning and context. I mean, it was so, his whole series was such a, you know, I've both of us, I believe, were members of Journalist.
Right.
And, you know,
It had no relation at all to what the list actually was. That's right.
And the other thing is that Micah Sifry's piece, you know, on the one hand, I thought was a corrective. On the other hand, I don't like this thing of going back.
Remember when you were in college and you did this, right? I mean, that's what I guess I was trying to get at. This sort of like poor Jon Favreau, you know, groped Hillary Clinton cut out at a party. He got to keep his job, but, like, how many people were like, that is not for me? How many wise people are not able to participate in public service because of this creeping culture of sort of permanence?
Oh, my God. Right? When we stop this public conversation, I have a story for you.
I mean, it just makes no sense to me. In terms of, if you're thinking about the national good, you're thinking about the best and the brightest, the most appropriate person for whatever job, you know, can be thwarted by whatever it is they've done in the past. And that's certainly digital. I mean, that's part of our digital culture. And while people have very short attention spans, there is a sort of like internet real estate that is troubling in terms of its contribution to this blame, this persistent blame, this blame into eternity that I think.
Do you know
is
what
very
I wish
dangerous.
I had, something I wish I had written about and I didn't at the time, just because, you know, you have a lot of ideas that go through your head and not a lot of time to pursue them all. I actually kind of wish that I had written something against the flaying of that racist Harvard law student.
Uh-huh.
Not defending, obviously, what she wrote, but defending the idea that we take a kind of very obscure person, and people kind of argue, well, she goes to Harvard Law School, so eventually she's going to be
a public figure,
person.
Right.
So play her then, you know, but you don't basically pick out a totally obscure person and make her a kind of national pinata and ruin her life, and everybody kind of piles on. I mean,
right.
It's just a really, really
bad. It's just a dangerous game to start playing and not be able to put the toothpaste back in the tube when we're like, wait a minute, why are all our public servants these sort of like intellectually neutered? I mean, I really sort of, I'm constantly compelled by the idea of what the 130th Congress is going to look like. This would be in 2050 when we officially have a majority-minority country. Presumably, we'll have different types of presidents, although I'm not so sure Obama isn't the first to last for a while. But, like, what kind of barriers are we putting in place to avoid an actual representative democracy? And I think I fear greatly that we are putting in a lot of sort of, that we are creeping towards a space where we will not have a representative democracy, or we will not have people who are...
Well, we've never really had a representative democracy. I mean, if we did, we'd be ruled by morons.
But I've always expected, eventually, much like the way I expect gay marriage to become, the way people fulminating against gay marriage to be called out as bigots, the way the people who opposed integration were called out as bigots. I expect Congress to one day look like the country, but it just seems like it's not actually going to happen for some time, which is distressing, I guess. I don't know. I mean, what would you put, are we talking like 2050 if we still have a civilization, or a little further along? I mean, right?
If we still have a country.
We will. I mean, we will. But it troubles me that we're doing a lot of, we're sowing a lot of seeds that I don't think are being adequately contemplated. And of course, like as journalists, you know, we participate in that.
I've been contemplating only half facetiously. I've been thinking about starting a blog about how much I hate the internet.
there's some irony there, but like.
But it would mean spending even more time on the internet.
On the internet. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, I know we wanted to touch on this, but we're coming up on almost an hour. In the context of the oil spill, the forgetfulness, I guess, is the thing that I find the most sort of troubling about it. I mean, if you can't think critically about millions of gallons of oil floating into the Atlantic Ocean, what can you think critically about? And I think, you know, since, what, it was right around Earth Day that... that the Deepwater Horizon rig exploded. I mean, it's been months, and I, you know, every day until this week, there has been oil flowing into the Gulf. And the fact that there hasn't been like a sort of more centralized response, I think is due to the fact that it is completely mystified for the majority of Americans who don't live along the coast or depend upon the coast or the ecosystem or the local economy. It's not something that is relevant to us, and so we.
But it's also, I think, a sense of helplessness. I mean, there's just a sense of kind of numb horror. You know, what exactly are you supposed to do?
Well, I sort of have wondered about that. I mean, like, what about, you know, they raised $32 million in the 3 days after the Haitian earthquake by, like, allowing people to send a text message. I actually don't know whether there's been, like, a sort of similar project for the Gulf. But because it happened domestically, I sense that people are kind of like, oh, government will deal with that. People's sort of sense of needing to act.
Well, they should. I mean,
if it had happened abroad, I mean, Haiti is not that far from the United States, and there was sort of a huge human catastrophe that required an enormous amount of sort of technical support, human health support, that sort of thing.
Right, but the difference is that Haiti wasn't the fault of a big corporation. I mean, we actually shouldn't be having telethons to pay for something that should be coming out of the pocket of BP.
Okay, that is a fair point. But in terms of people's response to it, I think if it was, I mean, maybe people just gave money to the victims of the Asian tsunami in 2004 and then never thought about it again. But I do think that there's a difference between something that happens within our borders and something that happens without, because we're conditioned to sort of look at things that happen abroad and say, oh my God, that's terrible. And pity sort of floods you and you sort of take some sort of action. Whereas here there was anger. And then, yes, helplessness, because there was no real action to be taken. And it maybe it wasn't giving money, but I continue to fault Obama for not, I don't know what he could have done, but for making a case in that whatever Oval Office speech he gave for something.
The case he should have made was for some kind of sane energy policy.
Right.
Right?
And didn't do it. And in that sense, it's not Obama's Katrina, but maybe this argument has been made and I'm just recycling it. You know, he just needed to, it was like he said, he didn't, the sin of omission was as though he had told people, like George Bush did, to go shopping after 9/11, you know? It just, there was such an opportunity, and I feel like it had been utterly wasted. And, you know, the hole's been plugged. There's some other minor spill that's happening right now, but it's not, I mean, that moment has sort of passed, I feel.
Right, and it certainly doesn't seem to have changed. I mean, it might have, I think it might have postponed, you know, or might have thrown a wrench to some extent into kind of further offshore drilling. But yeah, it hasn't seemed, it hasn't really caused a big rethinking of.
Right. I mean, there was an energy bill coming through Congress that is dead now.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, that itself is sort of, it encapsulates sort of everything we've been talking about, but also the sort of attention deficit in the country and the sort of like distressing lack of engagement with serious shit. Ooh, shouldn't have said that, but yeah.
Well, I think you can. It's blogging, can I? Not
yeah.
TV.
well, maybe, I don't know. Is there a happy note that we can end
yeah,
on?
No, I think maybe.
To
we
be
can
honest, okay. Let's, yeah,
notes.
I mean, it's, we have a woman on the Supreme Court. That is good. We have a ruling in California that will hopefully expand equality for more folks. And I think we're coming home from Iraq.
I mean, the thing is, I actually think that the first 2 years of Obama's administration have been pretty excellent, considering. You know, I mean, he's
yeah,
done...
I remember our last Blogging Heads, I was very bearish on the presidency. I still have to think about it a little more. They've done a lot. I'm still very bullish on
Obama, but I just think, you know, one person can't do it all, and it's, you know, crazy to expect him to fix an entire, not just political system, but kind of an entire country that is broken in so many profound ways.
I think that's right. People tend to use good judgment from time to time. I think the mosque kerfuffle demonstrates that. So, you know, you win some and you lose some. But I guess we should jump. We're coming right about up on an hour. This has been a pleasure, Michelle, as always.
Yeah. No, I know, and we'll have to do it in person sometime.
Done. Well, enjoy this, everyone. Take care until next time.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.